The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Jose Mourinho takes Spurs top with victory over City. Were we the only ones to say what a great appointment it was a year ago? And why let Guardiola sign a new contract when we've been saying for ages that football has passed him by? A bad weekend for Pep then, a worse one for Pepe. Incredible power from a headbutt with no backlift. It's 64 games unbeaten at Anfield for Liverpool. That's ridiculous. Will every Fulham penalty miss be even funnier than the last one? Did David Coote not have a TV growing up? And did anyone know Danny Welbeck was at Brighton? All that plus Rooney and Pulis in the EFL roundup, a ludicrous penalty shootout in the States. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barney Ronne, good morning to you.
Hi, Max. How are you doing?
Yeah, tremendous. Thanks. John Ashdown, it's been a while. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. Thanks, Max. Pretty good.
And Barry Glendenning, it hasn't been long enough.
Hello, Max. How are you?
I'm good. Let's start at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Spurs 2, Man City 0. It's pretty much exactly a year since Jose took over at Spurs. Only Liverpool and Manchester City have taken more Premier League points during that time. It was Mourinho and Guardiola's 24th meeting in all competitions. Barney, you were there. Is it fair to say that Jose schooled Pep in this one?
Well, I mean, if he schooled him, he kind of has schooled him in exactly the same thing they've been schooling each other in for the last 16 years or whatever it is. I mean, it was incredibly sort of, it was almost like a Pep Jose tribute act. I mean, I described it to as a kind of Legends Tour kind of event. It was like Mike Tyson fighting Evander Holyfield again. There were no surprises in the tactics. But I don't know. I think I kind of went overboard in my article about this game on, oh, well, you know, wasn't Harry Kane brilliant? Wasn't it a triumph for Jose's tactics? And then you kind of look back and think, well, these games always turn on really small details. And City were unlucky. I mean, the Kevin De Bruyne shot that hit Gabriel Jesus lying on the ground, I think when the game was 1-0, that was ridiculous. I mean, that could have very... The handball was also a very close call. But then there's always this problem with football. You try and sift through the details and say, well, OK, it turns on these tiny details, but what were the actual trends here? And it does... You do feel that the score reflected the game in that Spurs seem to have such a grooved method and to have real sort of points of incision. Whereas City, you know, they've gone into one of those vague phases, a bit like me here, where you dance around a subject and there's a lot of waffling and whiffling and sideways talking without actually getting to the point. The point being that, yeah, Spurs are top. And interestingly, Jose Mourinho can play a kind of nihilistic double pivot system with Harry Kane up front, and everyone thinks he's wonderful and pisses their pants about how, including me, about how great he is. Whereas when Gareth Southgate does it, it's the end of the world. But I guess that's the difference between Premier League and international football, and being an extremely good manager and being a slightly indecisive one.
John, are you in the long list of pundits slash journalists who might need to apologise to Jose anytime soon?
No, I don't think so. They were just incredibly solid at the back, particularly Hojbjerg and Sissoko in midfield, who I thought were excellent. And yeah, if you score from your two chances, it makes a big difference. In all likelihood, I mean, it's not the most controversial thing to say that the best team tends to win the league, and that team will probably be Liverpool this season. But given that we're in a sort of special season where high energy teams might find it a bit tricky as the season goes on, Jose's kind of slightly lower energy style might be quite useful.
The pronunciation of Højbjerg, Højbjerg, as you know, is much discussed. The way you sounded it made it sound like the love child of Steve Hodge and Henning Berg, just Højbjerg. What a player that would be. Barry, lots of people writing that you may need to apologise to Jose at some point. Christian, on the Jordan Jarrett Bryan scale of feeling bad because of people you don't rate performing well, how does Barry feel after Jose's masterclass against City? Lloyd, if Spurs do win the league, can we please have Barry read out a list of Mourinho's most memorable quotes to a backing track of I Was Wrong by the Sisters of Mercy?
Yeah, he has surprised me a little. I mean, you can prove anything with stats, obviously. And if you look at most of the stats for this game, without having watched the game or read anything about the game and don't include the actual score, you could be forgiven for thinking Manchester City won by an absolute landslide, you know, dished out some drubbing. They had 10 corners to Tottenham's none, 5 shots on target to Tottenham's 2, 22 attempts on goal to Tottenham's 4, and 66% possession. But it was a very impressive Tottenham performance, and Jose Mourinho does deserve credit for that. He seems a lot happier at Tottenham than he was at Manchester United. I think maybe because he's living at home with his family rather than, you know, Partridge style in a suite in the Lowry, dining on room service and dismantling his Corby press and putting it back together again, his Corby trouser press, just to keep himself amused. Obviously, for a lot of people, living at home with their families would be a source of complete torment, particularly during a lockdown, but he does seem a lot happier. Also, the signings he's made for Tottenham seem to be an awful lot, so far, it's early yet, to be an awful lot more successful than many of the ones he made for United. I went, just did a little list of both. In United, he'd Eric Bailly, who's, you know, impressed sporadically. Zlatan on a free, that was good. Henrik Mkhitaryan, disaster. Paul Pogba, hasn't worked out. Lindelof, occasionally good. Romelu Lukaku didn't work out for him, despite him being a good player. Matic, meh. Alexis Sanchez, a disaster. Diogo Dalot, hasn't worked. Fred's okay. And then at Spurs, you've Lo Celso, Bergwijn, Reguilon, Matt Doherty, Højbjerg, and Joe Roden. They've all impressed so far. Roden hasn't really got a chance to shine yet, but I think he will work out as a good player. So there's a lot to be said for that. I don't know why that is, if that's something to do with Manchester United's diabolical recruitment policy compared to Daniel Levy being comparatively careful and parsimonious. But it was a good performance. He seems a lot happier at Spurs. And as Jonathan Wilson said, this is a very attritional season, and in an attritional season, a time of attrition, he who digs the best trenches will prevail.
So. I would say we shouldn't get too carried away immediately. There are two things. Like, firstly, they won't find a more willing victim than Manchester City. I mean, it's astonishing the space that was left for Harry Kane to play his raking diagonal passes into and for Heung-min Son. I mean, it's just the sight of Kyle Walker sprinting back towards the Manchester City goal with his arms pumping, looking desperate, and his astonishing pace as he remedies these vast... I mean, that doesn't that ring any alarm bells? It's just amazing that Pep Guardiola can be such an incredible manager and know so much about football and his players. And you get these weird moments in football where you think, actually, that guy is too close to his team to spot things. And sometimes you get those moments, because I don't like second-guessing managers, because obviously they know their players and they know the game much better than you or I, but the amount of space they left for this very obvious tactic was really quite weird. And also I think Spurs are in one of those periods where Premier League teams get ahead of the pack. The game starts working and it takes a little while for the rest of the league to figure them out and think, OK, what are we going to do about this? And we've had a quarter of the season, and they've had one of those little surges before other teams start to react against them. And people will start... They've got one way of attacking, and people will start to have a tactic against that. And how they respond to that will determine how successful it is.
John, how do you feel about Tanguy Ndombele? Because I love watching him play. I think Johnny Liu said it, like, the ball is the last thing to come with him, but he always seems to have it.
Yeah, he's brilliant. The turnaround there has been sort of... feels slightly un-Mourinho-like in that, you know, they seem to have... what appeared on the surface, a bit of a falling out. And Ndombele was a big money signing that was just going to be a huge flop. And yet this season, he's central to the way they play and has been just brilliant. Yeah.
I think the thing to remember with Mourinho and playmakers and creative players is that while you think, oh God, he's going to hate this guy, he's an incredible pragmatist. And if he thinks you're actually good enough and effective enough to help him win games, as with Wesley Sneijder at Inter, he will just immediately put all his reservations aside and say, yes, this bloke is fine. We never had a problem. And I think that's what he's realised with Ndombele. He works really well in that system. He can hold the ball really well and manage the transitions of that counter-attack style. And, you know, it's all fine. It's all in the past. Let's go and win together is his attitude.
Manchester City have made their worst start to a Premier League season since 08-09 with the club sacking Mark Hughes in the December of that campaign to make way for Roberto Mancini. What does that mean, Barry? What do we think will happen to City? I can only presume they'll just win lots of games and come second.
Well, I don't think they'll sack Pep, seeing as he's just signed a two-year contract extension. They're struggling to score goals. They seem to be over-reliant on Kevin De Bruyne. They were certainly over-reliant on him in this game, and he had a few shots but couldn't score. I think they might be missing Leroy Sané a lot, actually. I know he was out for a lot of last season, but he was quick and they gave him an option which they don't seem to have anymore. And some of their more junior players don't seem to be stepping up to quite the extent you would expect. You know, we saw with Liverpool, which we'll get to later, I suppose, that Jurgen Klopp had to rely heavily on players who wouldn't normally be in the first team. They all stepped up in that game. But, I don't think they'll go down, put it that way.
Wow. Sticking your neck out there, Baz. Liverpool 3, Leicester 0. Liverpool have gone 64 league matches unbeaten at home, the longest run in their history, beating the previous record set between 1978 and 1981. An extraordinary run. I've got a whole selection of D's and W's with no L's in front of me. The audio version is something like but it's an amazing record, John, isn't it?
Not the way you sing it, it isn't.
Do you think about that team that is talked about so much in the late 70s and early 80s? And for this team to beat that record, John, is amazing.
It's incredible. And particularly as we've been playing in, what is it now, 5 months of lockdown, where all the sort of general stats are suggesting that home and away form has gone out the window a little bit. And I think certainly before this weekend, there'd been more away wins than home wins in the Premier League. To maintain a fortress when in that sort of situation is, you know, doubly remarkable. Yeah, and you know, the team that they're able to put out, testament to Klopp's coaching as well.
Absolutely. I mean, Barry, we were saying on Thursday, I forget, it was either Liverpool to win this comprehensively or we all really fancied Leicester against an injury-stricken Liverpool with Jamie Vardy exploiting the high line. But Liverpool made this so routine, didn't they?
Yeah, I thought Leicester would give them a game and possibly win, and they were pretty poor. Too many of the players just didn't turn up, I think. They are better than the account they gave themselves in that game. But then you have to ask, was it a case that they were just overwhelmed by Liverpool's excellence? And, you know, for all his increasingly tedious carping about the schedule and how overworked his players are, Jurgen Klopp showed that he has plenty in reserve. He's, you know, more or less his first choice team picks itself. But when plenty of them are out injured, there's no shortage of willing volunteers to step up and fill in quite comfortably.
I don't know if you noticed, they've actually got much tighter at the back since Virgil van Dijk was injured. They've begun to keep clean sheets. Obviously, that's not to do with missing a very good defender, but something's happened there. It was supposed to be the loss of that building block. I don't know if it's refocused everyone into a kind of mania for defending properly. They've got a decent pace at the back there. But if you look at it, they had no Van Dijk, no Henderson and no Salah, who are the main players in defence, midfield and attack. And because the advantages of playing a total system team, where we play this way and that's it, and people come in and play the same way, they just didn't miss a beat. And it was extraordinary to watch. And Jota has really added something. Mainly because his movement is so good and so relentless that in a team that's constantly attacking, he's always in space. He's always making a brilliant run, even when the pass doesn't come. And I don't know. I mean, obviously, Klopp, that's part of the reason he recruited him. But in a way, the injuries they've had have forced them to refresh the team a bit and do something different. And they don't. They look fresh. It's quite a remarkable achievement.
Barry, did you like Johnny Evans' own goal?
I loved it. And I was almost as surprised as he was, and took almost as long to figure out what had happened as he did. And he was quite lucky not to make it a brace later in the game when he whacked one off his own post, so to speak.
Thank you, Barry. Yeah, he's got
Sorry,
six.
Poor choice of words there.
He's got six own goals. Richard Dunn on 10, Martin Skirtle 7, and Jamie Carragher 7 are the only Premier League players to have scored more. I thought, Barney, I thought Christian Fuchs looked old. You know, I think Gary Neville talks about one game he played where he was just like, oh, I'm not sure anymore. And I really felt for Fuchs yesterday.
Yeah, he hasn't quite reached the Gary Neville stage where at the end it was like, he looked like he was sort of riding a horse. He sort of couldn't run, galloping really slowly around. And you could see on his face, like, what am I doing here? And I can remember myself, I mean, we've all felt like that at times, but the other humans were just too fast and they were running away from him. It was kind of grim. But who knows? I like Fuchs and I think he's an intelligent player as well. Hopefully he'll stick about. I mean, Leicester have had their injuries too. I think they're putting a kind of band-aid on a few positions there.
If I'm not mistaken, Christian Fuchs keeps trying to retire and various people at Leicester won't let him because he wants to go and live in New York, where I think his wife lives and his kids, and Leicester keep giving him lucrative contract extensions and not letting him go. So it's not really his fault. He has tried to quit and they just won't let him.
Is he being held against his will, Barry? Do we need to...
More or less, blink twice, Christian, if you're in trouble.
Brendan Rodgers is treating me very well. Let's go to Old Trafford before we end part one. A tale of two penalties. David Coote gives West Brom one in the second half after Bruno Fernandes kicks Conor Gallagher in the shin. He then overturns it after looking at the monitor. Shortly afterwards, West Brom concede one of those handballs, despite it looking very much like Fred bundled Gallagher over in the build-up, which Bruno Fernandes gets two goes at because Sam Johnston was off his line. Barney, you really like talking about these things. The floor is yours.
I mean, there's something about Manchester United's games these days, isn't there? The whole thing is just a wrangle over a penalty for 90 minutes. There's this constant ongoing debate about the award, the analysis, the re-award, the execution, the taking, the retaking of penalty kicks. That somehow this glorious club, this beautiful thing, this part of the popular culture, like these red shirts flying forward, this, you know, Matt Busby's team, you know, of youth and attack and flying wingers, has become an incredibly tedious technical exercise in the award and execution of penalties. It's Bruno Fernandes' entire career at Old Trafford is him standing in front of a dead ball in front of an empty stadium while people argue about millimetres. And he joylessly converts it at the second attempt and refuses to even smile. It's just horrible. And the whole watching a middle-aged man staring at a monitor while Bruno Fernandes waits, it's like a vision of death. And everything is wrong there, everything. And if sacking the manager or having a revolution or just destroying the stadium, tearing the goals down, whatever it takes to stop this happening and to reinstate this kind of joyful athletic entity must happen, because it's just... And then if you watch the highlights, you're going to watch highlights of people staring at screens while you stare at your screen. The whole spectacle has become horrendous and I want it to stop.
So you do think that was a penalty for West Brom, or you don't?
It probably was a penalty and there was some terrible injustice. I just feel that we need to stop caring so much about handball has become this kind of grail. Handball is, it's like this criminal thing. It was invented to basically stop people picking the ball up to distinguish football from rugby. It would restore restore joy to so many parts of this game that's supposed to be joyful. I refuse to care about it or to talk about it or to be interested in it. Yeah, it was probably a penalty, but nobody learned anything, nobody won, and nobody had a good time.
G. Briz says, is there any sense to what Ian Wright says about penalty kicks, specifically about not allowing the Bruno Fernandes-type hop that causes keepers to jump and then have to change their jump and come off their line?
We're actually going to discuss now the run-up to the penalty kick. The run-up. Let's have a discussion about the run-up to the penalty kick. What about putting the ball down for the penalty kick? Is that bad as well? Should we discuss that? I mean, is this honestly where we've got to? Is Bruno Fernandes run-up in an empty stadium after we've all stared at screens for a bit? Is that acceptable? How do we police this? What can we do? What can we do about his run-up? I'm obsessed with his run-up. His run-up to the penalty kick. Oh, my God.
Wait till we get to Ivan Caballero's run-up.
Anyway, Simon says... Manchester United fan here. Never in Premier League history have I ever seen any team so good against big teams and so bad against not so big teams. The attacking talent is there. How is it possible to be that bad at breaking these teams down, John?
To be fair, although it was only 1-0 and Man United certainly didn't play particularly well, Sam Johnstone in the West Brom goal had a freakishly good game. It was absolutely fantastic. So it could have been, on a different day, United could have been 3 or 4 goals to the good, and that wouldn't be the issue. Although, you know, the reality is it was only 1-0 and West Brom had a couple of decent chances themselves, I suppose.
And they might have had a penalty, Barney. No, I'm kidding. Larry, do you have any sympathy for West Brom? And more importantly, do you know any of their players now?
Well, I do. Sam Johnstone, he had a good game. I found out on Thursday when I had to do a little preview for The Guardian that Branislav Ivanovic is there. I thought he'd retired about 3 years ago, but no, he arrived at West Brom in the middle of September, I think. And because they've been resolutely hidden behind a paywall ever since, I had no idea he was there because, let's face it, with the greatest respect to West Brom, you are not going to pay $14.95 to watch them play unless you have some particular affiliation to them, which I don't. And I think even if you do, quite a lot of West Brom fans haven't paid it. Yeah, they should have had a penalty. They didn't get one. And I suppose when your luck's out, your luck's out.
That'll do for part one. We'll start part two at Elland Road. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly, to Elland Road, where Leeds absolutely smashed Arsenal 0-0, certainly in the first half. There was something about the way Leeds play when they attack at pace that to me looks, I don't know, different and sort of more poetic than when other teams do it. Is that true, Barney, or have I just been drugged by Bielsa fanboys?
Yeah, I mean, your obsession with Jonathan Wilson is... it's something we don't talk about probably enough, but I think you know what I'm... But no, what it is, I think, is that football is a really weird game because there's all these billions of variables in where the people move, where the ball goes, but it is still these very set patterns. Like, it's weird that more strange things don't happen, but they don't. The players and the ball go in the same spots again and again and again. But with Leeds, there are variations. Like, the players run into different spaces at different moments. And that's such a shock. That's such a revelation. Hang on, there's a man there when that man's there. And it's weird. And they have overloads where there are two players in the same space. And it's as though nobody's really thought that you can do that. And it's so thrilling to see this very slight textural change that it kind of slightly blows your mind at times. And they, because it's like a groove movement, they all do it together. It's very exciting, even in a 0-0 draw, which this was.
Pepe got sent off for... butting or rutting against Alioski. Arteta was very disappointed in his velour puffer jacket, saying it's unacceptable and answering the questions with very short answers just to show how angry he was. Some pundits' reaction. Hugh Laurie Pepe butted Alioski about as hard as I slapped my own forehead. Jonathan Liu, selfless from Pepe, sacrificing himself to improve the team. That's leadership. Connor says, should we make leaning into someone with your head, a la Pepe, a yellow card, and a proper headbutt, Zidane, a red? John?
Do you know what? You often see sort of people talk about attackers drawing fouls from a defender. But Alioski did somehow manage to draw the headbutt as Pepe was sort of coming towards him. He set himself up just a little faint to suggest he might do the head-to-head thing, and then just withdrew at the last second, almost forcing Pepe to lightly touch his head into his forehead and then go down.
Kieran Tierney seemed very upset about it at the end of the game, Barry. Without wanting to get stereotypical, I sort of imagined he wanted to explain to Alioski what a real headbutt was, had he got close enough to him. What do we make of Arsenal, Baz?
Well, just on the Alioski thing, I mean, it does look a bit wet when he goes down like that for not much contact, but it is a red card offence, and if he doesn't go down, it's possible the officials will miss it. Now, Pepe may well get a retrospective red card, but that doesn't benefit Leeds in any way. So I can understand, while tutting disapprovingly at his lack of manliness, I suppose, for want of a better word, I can certainly understand why you would go down in that situation. What do I make of Arsenal? I don't know. I think maybe Mikel Arteta is a good manager, but he has yet to show he is as good as perhaps we expected or hoped he might be. They're treading water a bit. There's still a touch of the Arsenal under Emery about them, or the Arsenal under latter stage Wenger. It's possible. I think people are expecting Mikel Arteta to be as good as Pep Guardiola, and maybe he just won't be. But I do not understand how Leeds did not win that game. I mean, they should have won it comfortably.
Yeah. Villa 1, Brighton 2. This was actually a really good game. Almost worth the $14.95 that it would have cost last week. Rick said, did anyone on the pod have any idea that Danny Welbeck now played for Brighton? That had completely passed me by. Lots of people, it had completely passed them by. But he says, nice to see him again, though. And it was nice to see him, Barney, wasn't it? And he took his goal beautifully.
Yeah, I did know he was there just because I noticed and thought, God, that's weird. But it's great to see him playing again. He's a really nice fellow who's had a lot of injuries and is a good player, and has these moments where you think, wow. It's weird to think Danny Welbeck was in that 2018 World Cup squad, which you kind of think he'd already kind of gone by then. But he was the reserve centre forward for Harry Kane at that tournament. And he also, I always look back at that 2012 Euros team, which he was in. And there was a game where Andy Carroll, Danny Welbeck and Theo Walcott all scored. I think it was against Sweden. And I remember thinking, and probably writing, this is it. We've seen the future of England. Tournament winning England is Danny Welbeck, Andy Carroll and Theo Walcott, who are fantastic. And of course, you know, that's pretty much that. Although Welbeck did have a good run for England after that. And his goal was a wonderful... To produce a delicate little chip like that on the end of a, you know, 50-metre sprint. Yeah, it's a real moment of quality.
The other real moment of quality was the finish from Solly March, John.
Yeah, terrific goal. One of those just sort of underrated players, actually, Solly March. He's always at least, sort of seems to be at least 7 or 8 out of 10. It was, I mean, I think I managed to watch 6 games until West Ham Sheffield United broke me over the weekend. And I think Brighton Villa was probably the best, just because neither side seemed to have any aptitude for defending whatsoever. Both sides are just much, much happier going forward. So it was a real knockabout fun tie with obviously, you know, lots of lovely penalty controversy to talk about as well.
Well, absolutely. And let's go straight to Barney Ronne for this. What did you make of that injury time challenge from Solly March?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's one of those ones, isn't it? You can stare at it for as long as you want and the shapes will sort of move and the the angles will change, and you know, we are all middle-aged people staring at a screen these days, and you know, at some point somebody has to make a judgment call on these things, and we all have to move on and stop. And that's really how I feel about it.
Barry, do you think there should be a law against sending Tarek Lamptey off because of how sad he looked when he was sent off? And I couldn't really bet. You know how I get emotional when I see, like, if I've got a hangover and I see like a little YouTube video of a raccoon eating cherries like apples, or have a hedgehog having his hair brushed with a toothbrush. A sad image of Tarek Lamptey. It almost put me over the edge. It was so early in the weekend's football, and it just made me feel so sad.
Yeah, you just want to pick him up and put him in the pocket of your warm coat, don't you?
And pet him, yeah.
He deserved to go. Not even he is above the law.
To Craven Cottage, Fulham 2, Everton 3. This was a fun game. Fulham with their traditional questionable defending and penalty miss. Everton with their traditional Dominic Calvert-Lewin scoring lots of goals. He's the top scorer in the league with 10. Everton's second goal was so nice, wasn't it? I mean, Fulham weren't really there, but Iwobi ran past about 20 people. James, Digne, Calvert-Lewin. And there are lots of good English strikers at the moment in the Kane understudy role. Calvert-Lewin is leading that at the moment. How impressed are you with him, John?
Yeah, hugely. I mean, he did come through at Sheffield United when they were a League One club. And, you know, when he was I think I'm right in saying 18-ish, sort of broke through into the first team picture. But he looked like an 18-year-old. He was, you know, kind of thin, really, and got knocked off the ball, you know, by League One defenders all the time. When he played, he just was so far off being ready, even for League One standard, that it was a huge surprise, really, when Everton paid, I think it was $1.5 million. It might not even have been quite that. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, this is a very strange sort of signing. I hadn't really seen, you know, the sort of tools that you might need at the top level. So his improvement over the last year to 18 months has just been remarkable, and he's now absolutely the understudy to Kane in that England team. And if he did have to play for whatever, you know, if Kane does get an injury, then, you know, you'd be perfectly happy with Calvert-Lewin up front. I mean, the goals that he scored at the weekend weren't exactly sort of you know, beat three men 30 yarders. There was a sort of a botched clearance that came off his shins and a 5-yard tap-in, but you can't really argue with, what is it, you know, 13 goals so far this season.
Yeah, Everton were hugely impressive. James through the middle, I thought, yeah, that will work, because as good as he is going forward, I think he when he's playing on the flank, he doesn't do attend to his defensive duties, which sometimes leaves Seamus Coleman exposed. Coleman wasn't playing yesterday, obviously, but yeah, it was a good win for Everton. I felt a little bit sorry for Fulham. Scott Parker said afterwards that they weren't aggressive enough in the first half, and he was probably right. And this habit they have of giving away very early goals is just giving themselves mountains to climb in games.
Yeah, Scott Parker said, "What I'm asking for in the first half is not something that you can coach," which is quite a fortunate thing for a coach to say, isn't it? they've missed 5 of their last 8 penalties in the Premier League, including each of their last 3, all taken by different players: Mitrovic, Lookman and Cavallero. Newcastle 0, Chelsea 2. The review of the game that I've written is Timo Werner is fast and Newcastle aren't very good. I feel that as a pod, we're not necessarily being fair to Chelsea, in the sense that they're really doing quite well and have been doing quite well for quite a long time now. But I need someone to add some much-needed analysis beyond my sort of very oversimplistic view of this football match. John Ashdown, can you provide it?
Well, probably not, no. But I do think if, you know, although Newcastle were pretty dreadful, and just incredibly defensive in that sort of 5-4-1 that they set up with, I think part of the reason, if you wanted to sort of flip it around and give Chelsea a bit of credit, is that they now carry that fear factor, and it sort of forces teams like Newcastle to go, well, we've got to set up with essentially 9 defenders and just hope for the best, sit in, hope for the best and try and nick one. And to be honest, I mean, Newcastle never really looked like holding them out at any point. Chelsea were, yeah, were great, and Werner especially seems to have added something something that they really needed.
Yeah, I think Ashes is right. I mean, look how good that Chelsea team is. That 4-3-3. Look how good the midfield is with Kante in the holding role. It's really balanced, and look how good the fullbacks are. You know, they've got Chilwell and Reece James, who I think is fantastic. They've just got a really good team suddenly. And even though Frank Lampard has allegedly never watched a football match before and doesn't know how to configure a team and is utterly lost, he has no wing mirrors, we hear. He somehow, in his bungling idiocy, managed to put loads of really good players in what looks like a balanced team. And I mean, they look like a team that should be challenging to win a league title. I think they look fantastic.
Jonathan Wilson on the pod on Wednesday, by the way. and the way that Timo Werner waltzed through the defence, Barry, for Abraham's goal was just delightful, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Excellent. Thanks so much. Sheffield United 0, West Ham 1. The Tin Booney says, with West Ham impressing this season, has David Moyes put himself in contention for the Manchester United job? 1 point from 9 games for Sheffield United. It's not the best. Ash, as you are a Blade, how do you feel about all this? Has this come as a massive surprise to you?
Yeah, I think it's probably fair to say that it has, given how good they were last season. And you don't sort of fluke your way to a top 10 finish in the Premier League. They genuinely deserved it. But the problem has been, you know, the lots of little problems have kind of gathered together to make one big problem, which is, you know, 1 point from 9 games. And the key one, I think, is Jack O'Connell, his absence for pretty much the season from left centre back. You know, a lot is made of the overlapping centre back stuff as an attacking option, but defensively, I mean, it's been shown that he was absolutely crucial. In fact, they haven't managed to keep a clean sheet this season is a testament to that. And although, you know, against West Ham, they weren't sort of miles out of the game. It was pretty even on a different day. It could have quite easily been a draw, and they might even have nicked it. They were just slightly worse than West Ham all over the pitch, and I think that's a little bit worrying.
Is Ramsdale for Henderson a sort of slight step down as well?
Oh, it's a big step down. I mean, I think Ramsdale's a really good keeper, but you've gone from, you know, Dean Henderson, who for my money is probably the best English keeper around, to Ramsdale, who's maybe what, the I don't know, sixth or seventh. Best English keeper around, something like that. And it is a huge drop off, despite it being an 18 million keeper that they've got in. It's really kind of disappointing as a Sheffield United fan to see, you know, that your star man from last season sat on the bench for Manchester United.
Chris Wilder's not under any pressure, is he?
No, he's sort of in the Sean Dyche situation of the club and the fans, for that matter, I think, aware that, you know, he is, you know, by a country mile, the only man who can get even this sort of tune out of the players that he's got. Even if they go down rock bottom, I can, you know, I would imagine he'll still be there next season.
Sebastian Haller looked very disappointed to score, didn't he? And Rob says the only interesting part of Sheffield United West Ham was the commentators mentioning Haller's a goal away to Madagascar. Alan Smith remarked, Madagascar away must be nice. I picture Alan Smith thinking of talking lions, dancing lemurs and spy penguins from the films. And that'll do for part two. Part three, Ben Fisher will join us to give us an EFL update. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk about what's going on in the EFL with the Guardian's EFL correspondent, Ben Fisher. 23 days into Movember. I could describe that as, I would say, wispy at best.
I'd say that's a compliment, Max. I'm happy with that.
Yeah, you look great. Wayne Rooney's the Derby manager, sort of, isn't he? How did he begin his tenure?
Yeah, it wasn't atrocious, but it really wasn't too encouraging, I wouldn't say. The problem they've got is they're not creating too many chances. They're not scoring goals. They're the lowest scorers in the Football League, which is mad, really, when you think Wayne Rooney is there, and even though he's not the sort of striker he once was, the fact that he's in the building, you think that, you know, he knows what that takes. So it's not quite happening, and I do worry a little bit now where they go from here, because I think in an ideal world that he probably takes charge of the next two games as part of this sort of four-man interim team. But if that doesn't work, then you can't really give Rooney or Rossini a chance, I wouldn't have thought. So it's going to be interesting. They're probably going to take charge of those games against Middlesbrough and Wickham. But I do worry a little bit, because they are rooted to the bottom, and it looks a bit difficult.
They lost 1-0 to Bristol City. How's he playing, Rooney?
Yeah, it's tidy. He plays so deep now. At times, he's sort of dropping into that almost a back three in defence, you know, sort of quarterback role, if you like, really at the base of midfield. He did okay, kept things ticking over, but so much needed to happen for them to get anywhere near to scoring, and that I found a bit worrying. I just don't know. I think it's a problem. Let's face it, it's not really worked, this sort of Rooney experiment, since going there. In fairness to Cocky, who obviously was sacked, he had a lot of off-field turbulence to contend with. So it's never done at Derby, but it's not really worked. I do worry now that you've got two people in Rossini and Rooney who both, frankly, want to become managers. And, yeah, it's all harmonious at the moment. It sort of sounds good, but I do worry a little bit where it's going.
Ben, I read your report this morning, actually. Wayne Rooney in the quarterback role is kind of words that send this kind of shiver of fear. I mean, has there ever been a good occasion where Wayne Rooney has been playing the quarterback? It's so sort of the end of Hodgson. Wayne Rooney, having lived through that period, do you think when he puts himself in that role, spraying those kind of really obvious crossfield passes around, that maybe he's the problem? Is there anyone there who can tell him that?
Yeah, well, that is the sort of elephant in the room, isn't it, I think, Barney? On Saturday, it was worrying. It was very pedestrian, you know, across the sort of back five at times, if you like. And like I said, it was just such a slog to get the ball forward. You know, even the sort of faintest half chance was sort of met with, wow, this was brilliant, because it was so rare. It was so sort of to be cherished, which is totally wrong. And yeah, I do think it's a bit of an issue, because Rossini and Rooney had a little joke before in the pre-match about, you know, that's if you get picked, about whether he would play. And it was like, well, you know, that there in itself is probably part of the problem.
I remember a period at Manchester United where they really thought about playing Rooney in midfield. And this was discussed. They went through training, they experimented with it. And it was decided by the coaches there that he just didn't have the midfielder's instinct, the ability to change the rhythm. You know, just that's something you maybe have to learn, or it takes you. And it just was decided that wasn't going to happen. But he's now gone to a club where he can say, I'm going to play midfield. They were wrong. I'm going to right the wrongs of somebody saying I'm not midfield. I mean, yeah, I back Shay Given and Rossini to have a little word there.
No, don't get Barry on Shay Given. This is it's disaster from all angles, isn't it? Mike says, since Max, you did your When Did Reading Get Good segment on the pod a while back, they've lost every single game. Would you mind taking personal responsibility for this lovely tar? I mean, the wheels have come off. They're still in the playoffs, aren't they? But the wheels have really come off, Ben.
Yeah, I think they've lost four in a row, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, there is plenty of exuberance in that team. I do wonder if they are a little bit green, I suppose, that in itself typified by throwing away a two-goal lead at Bournemouth. And Bournemouth are very ordinary again in that first half. But, plenty of quality and technical ability. I do wonder if they're a little bit naive, maybe. But Ovie Ajaria, the former Liverpool midfielder, is probably the pick of the bunch there. Really exciting player.
Rich says, is Tony Pulis here to save us all?
Well, he needs to save Sheffield Wednesday first. they've got an interesting week, actually. Pulis goes back to South Wales on Wednesday at Swansea. Then they face Stoke, obviously his former club. And I think, in fairness to Pulis, he took Stoke to dizzy heights, places they never would have dreamed of. So probably deserves more credit for that than he kind of gets now as this kind of chief firefighter.
Well, the FA will look into the incident, which appeared to show Preston's Darnell Fisher twice grabbing Callum Patterson's genitals in their win over Sheffield Wednesday. So we'll obviously keep you posted on that one. Ben, you made some predictions that seem to be working out. And it's only fair, since after four games, I went through all your predictions that looked hopeless. So it's only fair that you have a chance to rewrite what was really unfair of me.
Well, I was feeling quite smug on Sunday morning, Max, I have to say. Yeah, Callum Stiles, Tyrese Campbell and Marcus Fors are sort of tipped to have a decent season, and I'm glad to say they're doing just that. I think it's hard to know who's the most interesting out of those three. Stiles with a worldie on the weekend to open the scoring against Forest. Tyrese Campbell, son of Kevin, scoring goals and doing plenty of sort of assists and really showing real sort of clever brain, if you like, off the right flank. And Marcus Fors scored in his debut for Finland against the world champions in the international break. And given that he's playing sort of second fiddle at the moment to Ivan Toney, really interesting player to watch. It was released by West Brom as a teenager.
Can you give us a pithy League Two update, Ben?
Well, in short, I think the most exciting thing is, I mean, what's not more exciting than Kevin Ellison scoring a 96-minute winner at the age of 41? I mean, and even more so, the fact this time last year, he told me that he was one of the most hated players in the Football League. So put that sort of cocktail together, just beautiful.
That is great, isn't it? So yeah, for Newport, who are top of League Two, Cambridge, who are, we're doing well, but our game was called off at 9:40 on Friday night. Southend said we haven't got enough players, which seems very Sunday League to me. It's the sort of thing I'd get on a WhatsApp about my Saturday team. But I sort of feel in these current times, I don't know whether I should feel that that's unprofessional and they shouldn't do it, or, you know, you've just got to be a bit more forgiving at the moment. I don't know what I'm meant to feel.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't look great, does it? But like you say, I think they're not the only ones with problems. Grimsby are in a spot of bother with Ian Holloway at the moment. Just a little thing I quite like. He said Bilal Mosny, a summer signing, was his Van Dijk a few months ago. He's since played 21 minutes. And during after those 21 minutes, Holloway said he looked like he died because he hasn't played for months. He left the club last week. They've lost five of the last seven. So not an experiment that worked out.
Oh, come on, Ollie. Oh, anyway. Well, look, cheers for coming on, Ben. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Ben Fisher, our EFL correspondent there. Now, Stephen Kenny will remain as manager of the Republic of Ireland for next year's World Cup qualifying campaign after being cleared of any wrongdoing by an internal FAI investigation over a supposed anti-English video. The FAI had discussions with a number of staff members and players, including the manager. Quote, the board has accepted the explanations provided and considers that the matter is now closed. Apparently, the video put together historical clips of the Great Famine, the 1916 Rising and Proclamation of Independence, followed by Ray Houghton's famous goal against England at Euro 88, which is, it's quite the jump, Barry, there, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure how interested various members of the Irish squad, particularly the younger ones, would be in that sort of stuff. He could have been, you know, a bit more recent and current, shown footage of me being relentlessly bullied by you and Barney, or footage of Priti Patel threatening to starve the Irish into submission over Brexit. But instead he went for the hoary old famine and 1916 Rising biscuit factory cliches. But I suppose the worry there is that there is clearly a mole in the Irish camp who doesn't like Kenny, and that mole needs to be got rid of. Things clearly haven't moved on as far from the John Delaney regime, where the FAI higher echelons leak like a sieve, as they would have us believe. But I'm glad he hasn't been dismissed, because I suppose they could easily have used that as an excuse to fire him on the back of bad results, which aren't entirely his fault.
Glenn makes the point, you know, that there are a lot of English-born players in the Irish squad. I mean, a lot of them, I haven't really checked, but most of the time, Ireland squads, half of them are basically English, aren't they? So,
not so much at the moment. I think that the 11 that started against Bulgaria last week, I think 9 of them were born in Ireland. I'm pretty sure it's 9, if not 10. All that stuff, it was a long time ago. A lot of people care about it, but I'm not so sure, you know, young 20-something footballers care. As far as I know, Irish history isn't really focused on in English schools, so a lot of them would probably have no idea what the hell he's talking about.
But I don't think being born in England would be a problem with that. You'll find few people with a greater sense of self-loathing than the English. I mean, I'd particularly like to see this anti-English video. I think it could be hugely popular. And I think I could probably produce a much better anti-English video. I mean, just basically pick anything that's happened from the last 4 years, do a little supercut of it, and you've got a fantastic anti-English video. More of these, please. And can we please leak the actual film?
Listen, we've really sort of run out of time. We should just congratulate Bodo Glimt winning the Norwegian title for the first time in their 104-year history, the first Arctic team to do it. Next time Lars is on, we'll go big on this. A lot of you wanted us to talk about the Orlando City, New York City FC penalty shootout with an outfield player in goal saving a penalty, looking very much like an outfield player in goal saving a penalty. Go and have a look at it. It's all over social media. We'll finish with this question from Ossie, who says, I'm Finnish, and I was sad to hear Barry wouldn't move here for love. Where would he move for love?
Australia. I'd probably move back to Ireland for love. Yeah, I'd be quite selective. France, maybe. Quite like France. And I speak the lingo a bit, so I wouldn't have trouble fitting in. I need to find love first before I can move anywhere for it.
Anyway, that'll do for today. Barry, thank you for your time as always. Au revoir.
Au revoir. Voulez-vous accoucher avec moi ce soir?
No merci.
Okay.
John Ashdown, thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers, Barney.
Cheers, thanks. Bye, everyone.
We'll be back on Wednesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.